Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're done with your Oreo?
Yeah, I'm done with my Oreo.
Okay, good.
Do we really know what happened?
The brother did.
The brother, that's what I thought too!
I mean, that seems like kind of obvious.
Hey, do you want to talk about death?
Yeah, I mean, that's
the murdery thingy.
Okay. You're going to jump right in.
Yes. Welcome to Mystery Murdery
Welcome
Thingy.
Welcome to Mystery Murdery Thingy. My name is Chloe.
My name is Mario.
And welcome back.
Welcome to 2020.
Long
first
time
episode
no talk.
Of the year.
Yeah. Oh, my gosh.
You know, it's
the year
fine.
Hit us, the first year hit us way harder than.
I just, real short, I was just listening to the 538 Politics podcast, and all of them are also sick.
Ah!
And they did a shorter episode because they were like, ugh. And Nate Silver, he was like, oh my God. He was like, he sounded like Bernie Sanders is what he said. So anyway, we've been sick and we're back and we might cough because we're still kind of sick, but here we go. Who's going to go first?
I want to go first.
Go first.
I want to go first. Because
and
I
Mac the cat is also here.
Mac's running around.
Yes.
I want to address this classic mystery and that one day Agatha Christie disappeared for a week and like no one knew where she was nor why. And you and I talked about this. I kind of, both of us didn't know for sure if, like, did Agatha Christie, like, straight up disappear, period?
Right.
Or what's going on there? And then I was like, I read on Wikipedia that she died of, like, natural causes. I think it was cancer, lung. It was something. Yeah.
Her death is not mysterious.
Not mysterious at all. So I was like, what's going on with this disappearance thing? Because I know there was a thing.
Because right.
I watched the episode of Drunk History on it, and
I read
three articles.
Yeah.
I love Drunk History. We
I know.
Stan.
It's good.
Macky Mac. Okay. So, a little bit of backstory. So, she was 36 years old at the time and already a success. She had come out with two novels, one, The Secret Adversary, and the other, The Murder on the Lynx. So, that was the two that were in circulation at the moment. Agatha and her husband, Colonel Archibald.
Yeah.
Colonel Archibald Christie were having some rough times. Their relationship wasn't the best. Pretty rocky. And it was in April of 1926 that her mother died, and she took it really hard. And it was also in April of 1926 that her asshole of a husband comes back from a business trip and was like, surprise, I'm cheating on you.
Oh my God.
He said that he fell in love with this, like, random woman named Nancy Neal. And so, obviously, she was devastated. But they did stay together because they had a daughter. Mm. So they stayed together for their daughter's sake. They eventually moved to Sunningdale, England by December of 1926. And on December 3rd, it was reported that her and her husband got into an argument, and that night she drove off. Later that night, it was reported that, quote, Mrs. Christie packed an attaché case with clothing and went out alone in a two-seater automobile, leaving a note for her secretary saying that she would not return that night, end quote. The next day, her car was discovered abandoned on the edge of a chalk pit slash, like, a quarry pit thing. Dangerous is the point. Near the city of Guildford, England. The only thing preventing it from falling in there, it was like on, it was found like on the edge. The only thing preventing it from falling in there was a thick hedge that got stuck in the wheels. And the only things found in the car were articles of clothing and various papers that were in that case. December 6th, the next day, was when the news of her disappearance displayed on the front page of the New York Times. Okay, so this was huge. Agatha Christie was very, very famous. And, this story was plastered all over the place, and it really went, I was about to say viral, but,
in the context of that time.
In the context of that time, correct. In the newspapers.
Yeah.
Her husband blabbed on and on, saying that she was having a mental breakdown and she was crazy.
And it's clearly hysteria.
Yeah, it's. I got that vibe a lot from, like, shit. Reading these, and that people still dismiss it as that kind of stuff today, but we don't know.
It's a mystery.
It's a mystery. Authorities searched for her exhaustively until December 8th, when her brother-in-law reported that, quote, he had received a letter written since her disappearance in which the novelist said she had been in ill health and was going to a Yorkshire spa for rest and treatment, end quote. However, the police were like, yeah, we're not buying that. And they ended up expanding their search, but they still came up empty. So actually, I think the number was like 15,000 volunteers over the course of 9 days. Math. We're searching for her. Over 500 police officers aided by airplanes searched the area from where her car was found. They even got her own dog to the scene to see if he could catch her scent, but that didn't work either. Quote, he whined pitifully and went about with his nose to the ground. The colonel and a police superintendent followed eagerly, but after 3 hours gave up the search.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
The dog had no idea what was going on.
Exactly.
I feel bad for that
dog. Going for a walk?
Right.
Exactly. With the only trace of her was her car on the edge of a pit. Mm-hmm. So at that point, they began to think suicide or foul play.
Sure.
Another interesting detail I would like to note, and we're going to get a little ghosty in here, was that Mrs. Christie was spooked by her supposedly haunted house. Quote, if I do not leave Sunningdale soon, Sunningdale will be the end of me. Was the quote she said to her friend. So one of the other theories that was thrown out there was she was, like, possessed or haunted or some shit.
Can I just say that this would make a perfect Doctor Who episode? That's what she was doing. She wasn't in any of those places. She was in the TARDIS and off on some other planet
and
some other time.
Stop.
I'm just saying. I've been binging Doctor Who for months, literally, so my headspace is
there. Like, some, like, ancient alien in her house that, like, they have to fight.
It literally writes itself.
Wow. Amazing. 1 week later, she's still missing. The only clues were three letters that she left behind. One to her secretary, one to her brother-in-law, and another to her husband. So the first letter to her secretary was given to police. One line in particular saying, quote, I must get away. I cannot stay here in Sunningdale much longer, end quote. The other to her brother-in-law was destroyed, and her husband refused to tell the press what the letter that he got, the one that was addressed to him, he didn't talk about it. He was like, it's personal. At this point, even more rumors start to surface, right? So some thought it was a huge publicity stunt, which her secretary denied. However, in the end, once she was found, her book sales went through the roof. So, I mean, regardless of what it was.
Would you admit it if it were?
I mean, I mean, I would admit it if it worked.
But it probably would have come out over the years. Right. If that really were the story.
Right. Others thought that it was suicide and that she was dead. And some amateur sleuths thought that it had been met with foul play. So police at one point even speculated that she was in disguise, like dressed as a man walking around London. Rumor had it that she even left behind a sealed envelope that was only supposed to be opened, like, if her body was found, like, in the event of my death. But there's no evidence of any of that. December 13th, the New York Times reports how her husband, the colonel, believes that she's still alive. December 15th, a couple days later, Agatha Christie is found alive and well. It's weird, because... this is an Occam's razor situation, mm-hmm. in that she was where she said she would be. She checked into a spa in Harrogate in Yorkshire, England, under the name Teresa Neal.
Hmm. Neal. Okay.
Archibald later claimed that his wife had been suffering from memory loss and that she had no idea why she was there in the hotel or why she signed in under the name Neal. He insisted that he had no idea where the name came from, and it wasn't revealed until years later that it was the name of his girlfriend, Nancy Neal. Hmm. The father of Nancy Neal even commented, feigning innocence, but like, or maybe he actually didn't know. I mean, we don't know. He said, in New York Times, it'll quote, "I cannot hazard any theory why Mrs. Christie should have used my family's name. My daughter, Nancy, is naturally upset about it, and so are we all. There is not the slightest reason for associating Nancy with the disappearance of Mrs. Christie," end quote.
Okay.
I know. And it wasn't until a couple years later, March 17th, 1928, was when Agatha Christie sued her husband for a divorce. Now, the words were sued her husband. Can you do that? For, like, sue somebody for divorcing you? Or do they mean that they just got divorced and that was the wording that they used?
No, you're suing the court to allow you to divorce the person.
Okay.
It's essentially saying she divorced him.
Okay.
She sued for divorce.
I was confused by that. I was like, if we get divorced, do I go back and, like, sue you because I'm, like, mad? Or, like...
So, you know, like, the movie Kramer versus Kramer?
Yes.
The reason it's Kramer versus Kramer is because it's a suit. You know, it's a court suit where you dispute how you're going to divide the assets.
Oh,
if you have children,
okay,
what are the custody
rights
going to be? So it has to get litigated in court. But otherwise, it's just the act of getting divorced. That's just, like, the technical name for it.
Technical. 2 years after that, she remarried, but so did the colonel. And he remarried to no one other than Nancy Neal.
Well, at that point, she's not Nancy Neal anymore, so, you know, no association.
Whatever.
Everything's fine.
So, there are a few main theories here. Memory loss. So, it is known today that severe emotional stress can cause short-term memory lapses. Things like retrograde amnesia or anterograde amnesia, which is... retrograde amnesia is losing the memory of recent events, and anterograde is the opposite, when you're unable to store new memories, create new memories. However, people still maintain knowledge of who they are when that happens, so it's unlikely that that is what she suffered from, if that was, you know, we don't even know. Her husband kind of spoke for her at that point. In the New York Times article, and you know the New York Times has been around since, you know, early 20th century or so.
Yeah, 1840s or
Well, they quoted themselves in this more modern article,
uh-huh.
and they had snippets of, like, what was actually said at the time. But that's what they talked about. Archibald was like, yeah, she has no idea why she's there, and, like, I don't know what that name is, and this, then, the other thing. But with that type of, if she did have that type of amnesia... she wouldn't have been, like, walking around totally clueless, like, not knowing who she was. And there was a writing in 2003 in Practical Neurology. Psychologist Myria Pujol and Michael Kopelman, and they're both psychologists at King's College in London, They talked about that Christy Maeve experienced a psychogenic amnesia secondary to trauma, and that can last anywhere from a few hours to a few months. And that affects memories of events that occurred immediately after a traumatic experience. But complete amnesia is still pretty rare, like how it's portrayed in movies and stuff.
Sure.
It's very different than how it actually is in real life. It's pretty rare for you to, like, hit your head and then all of a sudden be totally clueless about who you are and where you're at and your situation and stuff like that. Quote, Agatha Christie could have suffered from a dissociative fugue or state of psychological flight. Persons with this disorder exhibit all the symptoms of dissociative amnesia. Additionally, a person suffering from this disorder may seek to move well beyond his or her usual sphere of travel. And although the individual may suffer amnesia during a fugue state, behavior may seem completely normal to outsiders. End quote. And that's from Scientific American. The next theory was revenge, question mark? And I kind of like this one the best, in that the author of The Mystery of Agatha Christie by Gwen Robbins, she believes that Agatha Christie left intentionally. And so she knew about her husband's infidelity for a little bit.
Sure.
At this point, but it's still possible that she wanted to seek some kind of revenge and have, in like, way of separation and cause him some type of emotional distress. Maybe he wanted to cause the, she wanted to cause the affair between him and Neil to be, like, really painful and stressful, perhaps. Or it was a failed suicide. So I read an article in The Guardian detailed the theory formed by writer Andrew Wilson, basically saying that she tried to commit suicide over her husband's affair, hence the car being found on the edge of the quarry. However, she came to the conclusion, you know, one way or another, that suicide wasn't the answer. This wasn't the right thing to do.
Happens to a lot of people.
Yeah.
So and anyone who's attempted suicide and survived says they immediately regret it if they think they will die.
Yep.
And if you or anyone you know is suffering, call the hotline. Call, call the lifeline.
100%. Yes. Yeah. So, you know, she checked into a hotel to relax and sort out her thoughts. And it wasn't until she was found 9 days later that she went with the story of memory loss.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe a bit of both theories, in that she tried to commit suicide, crashed a car, hit her head pretty hard, and then had a bout of amnesia, question mark, maybe? But
basically
honestly,
the plot of Mulholland Drive.
Yes, I don't know what that is.
It's a David Lynch movie.
Okay.
It's basically the plot of Mulholland Drive. Sorry.
But basically that's it. Mm. That's my story.
So, first of all, New York Times, 1851, founded, just to answer that question.
Okay.
And, I think probably the one I think is most likely is that she did it intentionally, and that she knowingly left and just got out of town, and a combination of the stress of losing her mother just caused her to intentionally want to disappear for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And she chose to do so. And then she chose to reappear and not explain why, which is completely her right.
Yeah, that's fair. It was a really big thing. I wanted to do something kind of short and sweet this episode. And, you know, everybody loves Agatha Christie and she's such a star. But this was like a huge thing when it happened, like people really freaked out, and there were like amateur sleuths and like psychics who were like, oh, she was murdered, met with foul play, and it's like that wasn't the case at all.
And it just it's something that would seem to happen in an Agatha Christie novel.
Exactly.
Play, so
exactly
sort of redounds to that as well. So
but, I said, her novel sales went up.
Good for her. And obviously she went on to greater and greater success. So.
My sources one of my main sources, the New York Times article, When the World's Most Famous Mystery Writer Vanished by Tina Jordan, Scientific American article by Stefania De Vito and Sergio De Sala. And I really like that one because they really dove into like amnesia and how it works and like the psychological effects and how like they applied it to that situation, how likely it would be.
Yeah.
And an article in the Telegraph by Camilla Turner.
Cool.
And that's it.
Sounds good.
Okay. That's all, folks.
That's all we got.
It's your turn, Junior.
And for you, now it's my turn. So I am going to talk a little art history, you know, Renaissance history today, sort of as a little bit of a hint and context for what I'm going to talk about next week.
Okay.
So, yeah, you can figure it out. Do some Googling. So I'm going to talk about the mysterious life and death of the artist called Masaccio, or known as Masaccio, because he wasn't born as Masaccio. But
Mustachio?
It sort of sounds like mustachio, but it's not that. It's Masaccio. I don't speak Italian, so I could be probably butchering it. But he was born as Tommaso di Ser Giovanni di Simone.
Oh.
And he was born on December 21st of 1401.
The solstice. Oh, 1401. The, okay, so solstice. This is some, like,
yes,
really
yes.
His
early
history.
Renaissance. Early in fact, Renaissance. We'll talk about how he essentially was sort of the spark for the Renaissance, in a sense.
What a guy.
Yeah, and he's, in fact, probably the most influential artist that you've never really heard of, right? We've heard of, you know, Raphael and Donatello and the rest of the Ninja mm-hmm. Turtles, right? He didn't get to be a Ninja Turtle. and he's not as well known as some of the later masters, but he's sort of seminal in a way. And he did all of that, and he only lived to 26.
Oh,
didn't even join
sad.
The 27 club. Didn't make it to the
wow.
to his birthday on that final year. But like I said, some people consider him to be sort of the catalyst for, you know, not only the Renaissance in Italian painting, you know, at the beginning of the 15th century, but also what would stem from that, which is the wider Renaissance throughout all of Europe and the wider world and sort of this, you know, setting up of the modern state of Europe, right, in a way, from an artistic perspective. But very little is actually known about his life, and as we'll talk about, almost nothing is really known about his death. But there are obviously, just like with the Agatha Christie things, a lot of rumors and
yep.
stuff. People like to talk. So what is, though, known about Masaccio, or Tommaso, as he was then known, was that he was born in Tuscany. For some reason, his date of birth is very particularized, December 21st of 1401. And he was sort of born into this middle-class family. So according to Wikipedia, quote, his father was a notary and his mother was the daughter of an innkeeper, close quote. So, sort of middle class. And tragedy, though, struck early in Tommaso's life when his father died, when he was only 5 years old.
Uh-huh.
And about, I think, 6 years later, his mother remarried to an apothecary, which is an interesting old-timey thing that we don't do anymore. And now we call them pharmacists.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little bit different. But this was the 15th century. Apparently, as Tommaso grew, he was apparently a little bit moody, kind of a withdrawn teen. In modern parlance, you might call him a little bit emo. You know,
okay.
he's that he always had that artistic kind of emo,
grunge,
yeah, kind of thing.
Angry at the world.
Yeah, well, one of the articles that I read did explicitly compare him to Kurt Cobain. So,
okay.
I mean, the grunge comparison. You know, you and a writer at the Guardian are thinking
yeah.
along similar lines. So good for you. And good for him too. And, it was also said, according to Simon Goddard at The Guardian, that Masaccio was, quote, so preoccupied with drawing that his bedraggled appearance became local legend. The affectionate nickname Masaccio, the 15th century Tuscan equivalent of Scuffy Git, close quote, which is an English phrase that we don't use in America necessarily. a scruffy git, but it's great. I love it. So while this, you know, definitely points to a sort of artistic bent, like I said, for Masaccio that he perhaps sort of always had, none of this would really suggest that he would, in just a few short years, rocket to, you know, fame and to become the sort of seminal artist that he became. Because one of the most mysterious aspects of Masaccio's life is where and how he learned to, like, draw and paint, like, especially as well as he did. like, literally there's no known record of him ever having had an artistic apprenticeship, which was the norm at the time.
Prodigy.
If you wanted to do this, right? Well, we just don't know. It could be that he was...
I like to believe, you know, he's a prodigy.
That he, yeah, that he just sort of was endowed by his creator, right? Whatever you want to say, you know, with this ability, or maybe we just don't know with whom he learned how to do this. Another theory is that he may have apprenticed as a draftsman.
What's
and
that?
To make plans and stuff, like architectural plans.
Okay.
But and maps and things like that, but that he then was more interested in doing art and just, you know, pivoted over to that, but never like studied under a master necessarily. So we don't really know. But there are people that art historians point to and say, well, maybe it was this person, maybe it was this person, based on his style. And it's also not really certain where Masaccio first began to paint or paint professionally, but he sort of shows up in the history books, in a sense, by signing his name into the roles of the Painters Guild in Florence. Again, hint as to what I'm going to be doing next week, Florence. In the Arte de' Medici e Speciale, the art guild there in Florence. So by the time he signed his name on January 7th, 1422, right, at the age of 21, Masaccio had already, 20 in fact, Masaccio had already become a independent master. So at this point, he was set up on his own, he wasn't studying, he was graduated and out there making money with his work.
It's hard.
Yeah, it's sort of crazy. I mean, to me, it almost sounds like an NBA star, right?
Okay, yeah.
Where you skip college, you know, and you just went straight for the pros,
right?
Because he was that good. He had honed his craft and was already being sought after for commissions, you know, from Italian nobles and whomever. And another sort of mysterious aspect of Masaccio's career is his relationship with this other guy, his frequent collaborator, at least for some of his career, named Masolino de Pinacle. And while Masolino was older, it's sort of not thought, I guess, by art historians that he was the teacher or mentor or whatever, that he wasn't the one who made Masaccio. Masaccio came fully formed and they were sort of partners, even though Masolino was older and sort of naturally would have fulfilled that role. To me, it almost sounds like the relationship between Basquiat, right, and... God, I can't think of things when I try to. The older artist, famous pop artist that I can't think of right now, who's super famous and obvious, Andy Warhol.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of sounds, maybe it was like a little bit like that, but what were you going to say?
I thought you were going to start telling me how Mustachio is like an LGBTQ icon and like...
No. And hey, we have no idea. So why not put that on it too? Somebody should make a movie.
I thought you were going to like start talking about how they were possibly lovers.
Somebody
and, like...
should make a movie where he and Brunelleschi or whatever his name is are like secret lovers.
Oh, I love
That'd be
it.
Great. That'd be great.
I'm in.
But you know, for obviously that and all of these things, there's not really any documentary evidence necessarily to point one way or the other.
Right.
We just don't know that much about what he was doing or what was going on other than his work and little hints. But another thing that sort of points to the fact that that Masolino was probably not his like master or whatever was the strongly contrasting styles in the paintings and frescoes that they did together. In other words, you can tell the parts that Masolino did and the parts that our boy Masaccio did. Partly because Masaccio's style is actually much more interesting and mature than Masolino's, despite the more advanced age of the latter. Again, Masaccio was already a master. And... let's talk just a little bit about why is he a master? What did he do? Why is he so great? Why are we talking about him in this sense? To put it really simply, essentially, Masaccio is credited with introducing the idea of perspective into the mainstream of Western painting, Italian painting, and then moved on from there in the Renaissance. He's also credited with being one of the first to use what's called a vanishing point. So
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, where everything comes together.
Yep.
The archetypal example, of course, is the road, right, thinning as it sort of is painted into the background to give the illusion that it's vanishing into the distance. But
that was him? He, like, kind of...
Well, he was one of the first. And okay. He, that, along with other things that he did, sort of popularized a style where that, later on in the Renaissance, simply became de rigueur, right? You had to do it. Before that, almost no one did it. Everything was very flat, right, and unnatural. Masaccio is credited with introducing that sense of naturality and therefore a sort of humanism into his paintings by depicting people and objects more as they actually are in real life, and therefore imparting more importance to real life, as opposed to before it was thought that was sort of sinful in a way. Right, we're sort of getting past some of those things a little bit by the start of the 15th century, at least in Florence, I guess. He sort of started to reform. Oh, okay, yeah, a good example of this, if you want to look at, go to Google right now, Google Images, type something in. So the painting Trinity with the Virgin, St. John the Evangelist, and donors, or it's sometimes just called Holy Trinity. By Masaccio, was painted sometime between 1426 and 1428. And literally, when I first looked at this, I thought that it was literally a sculpture because the perspective and the proportions are so convincing, and he does it so well.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It really is. Like, I would, if you can, go and, like, look at this piece. And it's, you know, to me, it's certainly a masterwork. You know, we obviously are seeing it with sort of jaundiced eyes as well, right? Imagine seeing this at the time next to a bunch of flat, unrealistic paintings. You can get a sense of why.
It would have been very awe-inspiring. Yeah.
Exactly.
Because it's all, like you're saying, it is very realistic. And it's very,
affecting.
Yes. It's a tribute. It's a very well-done tribute.
Yeah.
To the Holy Trinity.
It is. It's very appropriate, but very interesting as well. So there was also this relationship with Brunelleschi, right, where this is, you know, some of the mystery is also, okay, how did he do this? Why did he do this? Where did he get this idea from? We don't really know. But he was friends with these guys, Brunelleschi and Donatello, Brunelleschi being an architect, Donatello being a sculptor. And maybe he sort of took the techniques from them and applied that to painting, and therefore was able to create this sort of more sculptural, architectural aspect. And maybe that's what sparked it and gave him the ability, know-how to really do that. And undoubtedly, another sort of, you know, point that created Masaccio as he became was his going to Rome in 1423. He would have been able to see, you know, both the most modern works of fresco, painting, sculpture, architecture, you know, in a lot of the modern world at that time. But, you know, a lot of the works of the ancients as well, Greek and Romans, and people say that they can see that influence in his works after that point as well.
Did he ever do sculptures?
Not that I ever heard of. The only extant pieces we have of his are frescoes, okay. And I think he mainly did frescoes, I believe, after a certain point. That was where the money was. Not that that was necessarily what he wanted to do. Maybe he wanted to do sculpture. Maybe that's another reason why he did it. You know, like I said, he was good friends with Donatello. He sort of learned, you know, got this influence from Rome, and then he funneled those influences and, of course, his own unique idiom, you know, into that style. And this is why he's important. So, you know, just to kind of answer that question. And as Masaccio's career sort of reached its zenith, right, as he was unfortunately approaching his untimely end, there were signs that things started to go kind of awry, or there was a disarray generally in the signs that we have. Masaccio and Masolino were, for example, working on a major commission of frescoes at the Brancacci Chapel beginning in 1424, but mysteriously, Masolino, the older one, left to go to, like, Hungary or something, but no one knows why. Was it money troubles? Were they fighting? Was there some kind of artistic difference
between
them?
So he straight up left? It wasn't like he left on a trip planning to come back, or he left like he moved,
it
or we don't know?
Abrupt.
Okay.
It's not entirely clear, but it seems like it wasn't just, like, a planned trip, but it's sort of obscure, right? Like, a lot of this stuff. You know, there were also possible financial issues with their patron that they were working for at that time. So, you know, people didn't know if he maybe had to go somewhere else to, like, just to make more money. I don't know. But there very well could have also been some kind of artistic issues. Because, like I said, Masolino's style and Masaccio's style weren't necessarily that compatible, even though they did all these works together. Mm-hmm. That in and of itself is kind of a mystery to me. Like, why did they continue to work together all this time? I don't know. All of it remains very much mysterious. Masaccio also left off those chapel frescoes in 1426 for unknown reasons, maybe financial. But despite these sort of career machinations, Masaccio, in the penultimate year of his life, won yet another prestigious commission for the aforementioned Holy Trinity that we were goggling over, which was for the Santa Maria Novella Dominican Church in Florence, Dominican sect of Catholicism. Apparently, one can still see actually some of the preparation work that Masaccio did for this painting, like where he literally put a nail in where the vanishing point was going to be and then used string to like map out and sort of gridded it out. And again, you see this technique mirrored later on in the Renaissance. Mm-hmm. Literally, painters would go and look at this and say, oh, this is how he did it. And then they would do it. So we talk about his, you know, he had that kind of direct influence on what came later. And this is sort of, you know, the lasting legacy that he left. But there's also a lasting mystery that we just don't really know a lot of what works are actually his, at least in part. That's very mysterious. People debate over it, right? Because it wasn't like later on when, you know, painters would sign their name and everything, you know, it wasn't like that. You just kind of had to have to figure it out to some extent. Be an art historian. I don't know. That would be cool. I love art history. But not that I know it that well. But anyway, so apparently there are four, like I said, extant frescoes that we like positively know are his. A lot of others fall into sort of the maybe category. But in any case, after Masaccio had completed that, you know, the famous Holy Trinity, he returned to Rome, and that would be the last trip he would ever take in his life. It was there sometime in 1428, we really don't know even exactly when, that Masaccio died somehow. We have no idea. Like, there's no record. It's just a complete cipher.
Do we know the day of death?
No. We don't even know when in 1428 it happened.
But
than it was before his birthday. But that was December 21st, so it's like the last weeks of the year. So I'm not really sure.
Okay, keep going.
But there's a popular myth, of course, that he was killed.
Okay.
That it was foul play, that it was murder, and that he was in fact poisoned by most likely a rival painter, jealous of his fame and whatever. But that's pure speculation.
I mean, he's so young.
Exactly. So, I mean, it would seem to suggest, right, that his death was somehow unnatural, right? Because he did die at 26. People don't usually die at 26, even in 1401. So, yeah, it's probably some kind of unnatural cause. But
so did somebody, like, find his body, or did...
I'm saying there's not any of that information.
Wow.
It was just not out there. And people make a point to say that it doesn't exist in the sources that I read.
Okay.
So it's just, like, pure mystery. We have to embrace the mystery in this... Maybe it'll get solved. I don't know. Maybe some evidence will arise, you know, hundreds of years later. But it's a pretty cold case at this point. But, you know, yeah, not really any evidence one way or the other. And, yeah, that's pretty much all that we know and all that I've got to talk about Masaccio.
But I'm going to give the last word to Masaccio's friend, Brunelleschi, who said, quote, "We have suffered a great loss," close quote, upon Masaccio's passing, so which undoubtedly is true. So my sources are Simon Goddard at The Guardian, Naomi Blumberg at Encyclopedia Britannica, Kathy Hansen at Historical Research Update, and, of course, Wikipedia.
Good job.
Yes, thank you. So, yes, we are...
a good little mini-episode.
We are back with a little primer episode. Thanks for listening.
We're going deep.
Next episode is going to be a lot more extensive.
Ooh, I'm excited.
And I have to figure out I'm going to tell a complex story.
I don't know exactly... Well, you know what you're doing. I don't know exactly what I'm doing, but I was browsing today, and I was like... I have a lot of possibilities. I have a lot of missing person cases. Mm-hmm. But do you have weird shit in the news? Because I have some weird shit in the news.
Do you want to go first or me?
Sure.
Okay, go.
So this is from cake.com, cake with a K. And it's taken
from... Cake always has a K.
It's taken actually from the Associated Press.
You mean K-A-K-E?
Yes.
Okay.
But it's taken from AP. It's taken from the Associated Press. Oh, okay, but it's posted on... It's funny how that works.
Yeah.
Anyway, the title is "Kansas Man Requests Trial by Combat with Swords to Settle Custody Battle with Ex-Wife."
I saw this headline.
Amazing, right? Well, weird.
Not good, just to be clear.
His name's David Ostrom of Paola, Kansas, and in a court filing, he said that him and his wife, Bridget Ostrom, and her attorney, Matthew Hudson, had, quote, "destroyed him legally," end quote. And, yeah, so it's a custody battle, visitation, property tax payments, and, like, we were talking about divorce.
Right.
Quote, "He wanted to resolve our disputes on the field of battle legally." And he also asked the judge for 12 weeks' time so he could secure Japanese samurai swords.
Takes a while. Shipping.
But,
gotta secure the funding.
Yeah, it's pretty wild. And, of course, they're like, quote, "Until the proper procedural steps to initiate a court proceeding are followed, this court will take no further action concerning any motion, objection, or petition filed by either party at this time." So, they're like, cut the bullshit. All right.
Let's all take a cooling off
period.
Cut
the bullshit, David.
We'll stop talking about ninja swords. Please.
This is serious. We're adults.
Right. That's cray cray in a bad way. I just want to say that.
Okay.
Can I just say that one thing?
Yep.
Also, I have some weird shit in the news. And it is this persistent story that we've been seeing, right, about the drones, right? The mystery drones.
Yeah.
The fleets of mystery drones. And they're in Colorado. Uh-huh. And now they're in Wyoming.
I didn't know there were more.
Well, here's the thing. A lot of these apparently are not mystery drones because they've been looked into. And they're, like, natural phenomena, or they're drones that are owned by hobbyists or other people. And this guy in Wyoming also thinks that, hey, maybe the government or, you know, Northrop Grumman or Boeing or whomever, right, is secretly flying drones. Or maybe it's not secret to the Air Force or the government, but maybe it's secret to us. Lots of different theories, but... clearly, there are some drones that people on the ground don't know what they are, and people have questions. And I think they may or may not get an answer.
What is natural phenomena? What would that, consist of?
Sure. You see, a shooting star, and you think it's an alien. That kind of thing.
Oh.
You know, you see... literally, light coming off of, bouncing off of gas in the upper atmosphere, and you think it's some kind of UFO. That stuff happens all the time, actually. And it's very mysterious, but I think we're pretty much done, aren't we? I feel like we're running out of steam.
Running out of steam here. But we love you guys.
Thank you so much
for listening.
Thanks for waiting a month for new episodes.
It was the holidays, and you know, we're not the only ones who did a little holiday hiatus.
It's true.
Thank you for listening, and thank you for understanding our little lo-fi podcast. And we do this for fun.
We do it purely because we love mysteries and we love talking about them. And we got a new cat. His name's Mac.
Check him out.
If you have been following our Twitter page, you would already
follow
know that.
Follow us on Insta. Put us up on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter.
What's our Twitter again? Murdery Thingy?
Yep.
Murdery Thingy. And you can follow my Twitter at MarioTex30.
And you can follow our Instagram page at Mystery Murdery Thingy. Yes.
And that's our episode.
And that's the episode. Peace out, Girl Scout. Bye.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.